here at my invitation, in spite of all those government issues. So that's why I stay out of the room when Carolyn does her presentation. To give you her schedule for hours?
Yes.
Okay. Of all the people who tutor psych over there, she is going to be surely the one that I most frequently recommend. She does an outstanding job. She really loves this thing. It's free, and you're around the bend from your first test in here, so I suggest that you make it your business to get a plan to take care of it. I didn't announce it yet, but I just said it's coming.
Okay.
Probably not. My guess would be not this week. And if it's next week, it'll be the end of the week.
Next week?
It's 2 weeks in advance. And I mentioned it last week, so that really gives you more of an edge. What were we talking about in here last time? We had talked about various research methodologies, and I think we've gotten through the survey method. Okay. Good. Going to have to do a little writing for this one.
You think you can go over the blind study and the single blind study again, too?
If asked, but not right now.
Okay.
Let's see. A follow-up to something that was presented in the Zimbardo thing on an experimental. Yeah, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll work it into this presentation
okay.
So we can talk a little bit about it.
Thank you.
Let's deal with what's already on the board before we get over here. I've got some other things to put up here. What we have done thus far is to talk about methods of research used in psychology in sort of a loosely coordinated timeline from observational studies, empirical research, it's called, basing decisions and conclusions about behavior and what causes it and how it manifests itself through empirical observation, naturalistic and controlled. The second way, developed around the turn of the past century, was the survey method originated by G. Stanley Hall, the first person to design and construct and implement a questionnaire as a way of gathering data from large numbers of people through self-reported information. We said that one of the limitations of that is the fact that it's self-reported information, and there's no way you can consensually validate, confirm that information, because it's what a person says, it's what they report. So it's very personal, often highly subjective. Now, even though we try to trust people in terms of their honesty and the validity of what they say, there may be distortions of information because of lapses of time, because memory is highly selective, because people's perceptions can be, over the course of time, somewhat distorted. So there are some issues with self-reported survey kinds of information, whether it's done vis-a-vis a questionnaire, or whether it's done in terms of a structured interview, or whether it's done in terms of a telephone survey, an interview conducted over the telephone. I think it's important for you to note that there are some misgivings. And the other problem that we talked about with that method is the lack of responses, particularly in terms of the questionnaire method. And we said that we probably fare a lot better with structured interviews than with questionnaires because of the obvious limitations. Okay, that brings us up to the method that you see on the board, which was originally something that was called the CoTwin method of study. Let me see if I can encapsulate this in kind of a Reader's Digest version. CoTwin method of study is when you select a group of people that you want to do research on. You take those individuals and you pre-test them or evaluate them in some way to see kind of where they are, or what they know, or what they can do. And then you subject them to an experimental procedure, at the end of which you test them again. And you take a look at what kind of progress was made. What changed from the first testing or evaluation to the one, the post-test afterwards? Very often what is used are two different versions of the same test. So you're trying to research the same kind of information using just two different forms of the same instrument. And then what you do is to take these same individuals and you want to compare whether that process or procedure that you just put them through that affected some kind of change in their behavior, you want to compare that to another kind of procedure. So you pre-test them again, put them through the second procedure, and then you post-test them again. So that's one group, two different procedures, it's a comparative study. And what you then do is to take the final test from the first method and the final test of the second method, and you compare results. At the conclusion of both of those trials, which trial, which process, which procedure produce the greatest change, produce the greatest effect.
For
what?
Two for each.
Two for each?
Yeah. Okay.
Pre-test and post-test for each trial. So that's a total of four.
Pre-test, and then the final comparison.
The final comparison is the post-test, the end test, from both procedures. That's where the rubber meets the road. That's where you're going to really check out and see which one had the greatest effect, the greatest impact, produced the greatest change, growth, development, whatever.
Both groups have the same tests?
What both groups? One group of subjects subjected to two different processes, two different procedures. They are pre- and post-tested each time. You know what? This is going to sound confusing as hell. And if it does, that's a good thing, because out of this we're going to find some kind of direction. Trust me. Okay? Now, That sounds really good when you describe it in those kinds of terms. And that, those are the terms that were used. That's the way it was viewed, and that's the way it was looked at the time. This is the original experimental method in psychology. And please make sure that in your notes you refer to this as the co-twin method of study.
The original
experimental method in psychology. In addition to teaching and offering educational programs to traditional and non-traditional college students, going out in the community and doing in-service training and continuing education for various agencies and companies in Union County in its environment, Union County does some things that other educational institutions do that your typical student isn't aware of. For example, we have an Office of Community Relations, and through that Office of Community Relations, they frequently get requests from various organizations and agencies in and around Union County to have people come in and do some training, some on-the-job training for them in either business or industry, to have people go out to various schools and conduct workshops for educators, or in my case, I usually work with school counselors and school psychologists, members of the child study team, doing the kind of training that I do when I work in educational settings outside of here. We also maintain something called the Speakers Bureau, whereby people can call in and you belong to an organization and there's a specific topic or a particular issue that your group is interested in. Sometimes people call up the college and say, is there somebody there on your faculty, somebody who works at the college who has some knowledge or expertise in this area, because this is something that my group is interested in learning about, and do you have anybody who could come in and do a presentation for us? So we maintain the Speakers Bureau. What usually happens is that the requests go into the that office first, and then if it's some kind of training or seminar or workshop they want or in-service kind of thing, it's then apportioned out to the department that has the skill or the knowledge or the expertise that the people are interested in, and we try to see if we can make a connection to be of some assistance. It happens on a regular basis. I frequently get tapped for doing some of that kind of stuff, or at least I used to. So let us assume, for the purposes of what we're doing today, and that is to hopelessly confuse you so that out of that dark abyss you will find a light and a direction. Just be careful. Often the light at the end of the tunnel is an oncoming train, but let's see what we can do with this. Here we go. Somebody calls up and their dilemma is this. And this person gets referred to me for whatever reason, because I've done some work with schools, let's say. The request goes to the psychology department. My former office mate, now chair of the department, Dr. Signorelli, refers this request to me and says, see what you can do for this person. And it happens to be a superintendent of schools for a local community. And this man tells me that in his community, which is a rather small community here in Union County, they have been teaching little children how to read using a particular reading method for the last 7 or 8 years with a great deal of success. He tells me with a considerable amount of justifiable pride that the kids in his school system, the vast majority of them, somewhere between 75 and 80% of them, are reading at or above grade level for their grade in school. And they changed to this program because it was highly recommended to them, and they've been using it to teach reading in their schools for these years. And he says that recently he's been getting some pressure from the Board of Education in his community through the Superintendent of Schools office to change to a new hot method of teaching and reading that's just come on the market that's supposed to be better than the one he's using. And he's been getting a lot of pressure to make this change, but he says that before he makes such a change and sends his reading teachers for retraining in this new method before he buys new reading books, new workbooks, new ancillary materials for all the teachers and all the kids. What he wants to do is to see if somebody can compare the two methods of teaching reading before he makes the switch to see if the new method is really better before he spends thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars of taxpayer money on buying all new materials and equipment for a program that may not be as good. So his question to me is, can you conduct such a study? I said, I think we can, but give me a few days and I'll get back to you. I get back to him 3 days later and I have the following recommendation for a study. Since the school year is just beginning, here's what I propose to do. And now this is where you come into the picture. You need to listen and you need to think critically and formulate some kind of an opinion about what I'm going to say, because I'll be asking for it. I suggest that this month, in September, what we do is to test all the children in the elementary schools in his community, particularly those grades where you teach reading or lay the foundation for that, and that's in the first, second, and third grades. First three grades, the primary grades, are where you actually teach kids the mechanics of learning to read, and there are essentially five ways you can teach a child how to read, and the various methods are variations on those five things. I say, let's test all the kids in the first, second, and third grade in your school, and then what I propose to do is, starting now, I want to, after testing them, to see where they are and how effectively they read, or whether they're at grade level, and reading rate, reading comprehension, all that sort of stuff. I want to test them now, and then I want to teach them how to read using the old method, or the method they're now using in their school right now. And I propose to teach them using that method through January of next year. January 2007, at which time I want to stop and test all of those kids that are part of our study. And then beginning in February, the 1st of February, I want to pre-test those children again. And from February through June, June 25th or 26th, 23rd, whenever it is they get out of school, I want to teach them how to read using the new method of teaching reading. So I test them again, teach them how to read using the new method, and at the end of the school year, the very end, I want to test them again after using this new, supposedly improved and better method. And then I want to take the end test from the first trial that ended in January and the results from the testing, the second trial, which ended in June, and I want to compare the results to see how much progress, how much growth, and how much learning in terms of reading skills took place using those two methods. What's wrong with that stuff? One at a time, please. Sir?
The problem is that the newer method, you can't see if it works correctly because they've already learned how to read on the old program, so you're not starting off from scratch.
Okay. So? Is there a way I can compensate for that?
Yeah.
Or you don't think so?
Yeah.
Without changing the study?
Without changing the study.
If you can't think of one, mull it over. If you say I don't think so, I'd probably agree with you. But mull it over. Yeah.
No, that's what I understand. They've already learned partly how to read, so now their minds are working, teaching themselves, and you implementing the second method,
yeah,
is just reinforcing what they've already learned. It's not really teaching them anymore.
You know, he's as half right as you are. Half right. And therefore, yeah, teaching it. Go ahead. When you say confuse, can you help me with that? It's like when something happens to somebody and I say to them, and how did you react? And they say to me, I was upset. Upset. Angry. Ticked off. Frustrated. Devastated. What the hell does upset mean? That's one of those round wastebasket terms that we throw. I was upset by that. Upset? Tell me what... Okay. When you say confused, what do you mean? Just stopping and starting may not confuse them. What would confuse them? Wait a minute. Let her fight her battles here. I'll get to you in a second. Okay, go ahead. No. I want to hear you thinking about this. The different types of teaching reading. You want some help? Can you help?
Just the different types of ways that you're teaching or form of teaching, how it's going to be physical, and they're already at a set line, and how you've begun teaching. So you can change it would be more confusing or hard to understand.
You know, you're both right, and it's the other half of what those two guys are talking about. You're the other 50%. Sir?
I think we should...
Hold on. I don't want to change the study yet. I'm going to get there. I'm going to ask you what you think is wrong with this, and without changing the basic design of the study as I described it, is there any way to salvage this?
No.
Who said no?
Me.
Somebody just said no.
I do.
And there's no way to salvage this?
I don't think
so. And why do you think that?
I don't think there's any way that you could change the study and still effectively teach them. Not that I can think of.
This study?
Yeah, that study.
How many people in here are intended to go into nursing? Want to go to nursing school? Raise your hand, please. How many people would like to go into engineering? Anybody? How many people would like to go into education? How many people want to go into business? Did you know that there are actually people who believe that what you learn in college will actually make you a competent employee in one of those things? That what you learn in a classroom, what you learn in a laboratory, what you learn if you're going into nursing on your clinical floor experience, you will be able to take with you into a real-life situation and apply it? That's called transfer of learning. And every year we spend billions and billions of dollars around the world in a belief in a principle, and that principle is transfer of learning. That what you learn in one situation transfers to another situation. And if it's positive transfer of learning, it makes you a more efficient learner, a more competent student, a more capable and skillful employee. That's positive transfer. What you learn over here, you take with you over there, and you can apply it and use it and add to it. See these guys over here? They were talking about positive transfer of learning. That what they learned from September till the end of January has already set the wheel of progress in motion. And so these kids are going to be able to take what they learned in the first 6 months or 5 months out of that experience into the second 5 months and use it while supposedly being taught by means of a new method of teaching reading. So what's the bottom line there? No matter which method we use first, if the two methods of teaching reading are similar, it's always going to make the second method look better, even though it may not be. It's going to distort our results because the second trial is always going to look vastly better than the first one, because they're using what they took out of the first one and they're applying it over here, in addition to what they're learning over here. That's positive transfer of learning. The two young women over here, here's where you're right. If the two methods of teaching reading are drastically different, if we teach them sight reading for the first half of the school year and they learn how to recognize the letters of the alphabet and then how they're grouped together to form words and then to recognize the overall shapes of words as they appear on the line of print, and then we train them to read phrases and things like that, sight reading, and then the second half of the year, based on that experience, we test them and they're doing okay. But in the second half of the year, we teach them reading using phonics. It doesn't matter how the words are spelled. They're all spelled the way they sound. And we're interested in phonetic spelling. Those two methods of teaching reading are so drastically different that the second one is always going to look worse than the first one, even though it might be better for those particular kids. That's called negative transfer of learning. That's when what you learn in one situation transfers to another situation and disrupts the learning process in the second situation. So in high school, you took a modern language and you took Spanish. You get to UCC. You tell the counselor, you found the one who actually knows what they're doing, you tell the counselor that you want a liberal arts degree, straight liberal arts, because you're going to transfer after 2 years to a four-year school, and then you're going to major in something. And they say, fine. See, I find that we have some very capable people in counseling, and then there are the other counselors. And those are the ones who initially trained to be teachers, but got burned out in the classroom, but have already invested too much money in the field of education to jump ship. So they switch over to a field where they are a teacher with a telephone. They sit in an office and they need the qualities of a nice puppy, warm and trained. And they sit there and they talk to students and invariably are a never-ending source of misinformation to students. So what you have to do is you have to check out the counselor, make sure you got one of the good ones who knows the difference between an apple and a banana before they start guiding and directing you through the educational rapids. Here or elsewhere. This counselor knows what the hell they're doing, and they say, okay, that's fine, but I notice in your selection, a preliminary selection of courses that you want to take, that you haven't listed a modern language there, and did you know for the straight liberal arts degree at this school, you need 2 years of a modern language? I said, no, I didn't know that. Yeah, that's the case. So which language would you want to take? And you say, well, I took Spanish in high school. I've got a background in Spanish. How about you sign me up for Spanish? They say, fine. They pick up their pen and they say, by the way, before I sign you up for this, since you had that background and I see here you've had several years of Spanish in high school, that means you can't go into beginning Spanish at the college level. You're going into intermediate Spanish, and the course that's available to you is Spanish literature, and the only thing spoken in the classroom is Spanish. You're going to do sight translations. You'll stand up and read something in Spanish and translate it into English, or you read something in English and translate it into Spanish in class while you're doing it. Are you ready for that? And you say, time out. Whoa. I took Spanish in high school, but I'm not Spanish. I'd like to go into the beginning Spanish. And they say, well, you can't have it count towards your degree. Oh, okay. Would you like to pick another language? You say yes. What language would you like to take? And you can smell the wood burning and the wheels are turning and you're saying Spanish. What's something like Italian? We don't have Latin here, but we've got Italian. Spanish, Italian, hey, they're kind of close. So they sign you up for an Italian class. I tell the story to my students, and they look at me incredulously, but it's absolutely true. I have four children. Three of the four, one of them got a scholarship and went to Rutgers right from the beginning. The other three went to UCC first and then transferred to NJIT, and the others went to Rutgers, one went to Douglas. But I had two kids that were going to school here at the same time. They overlapped. And when they were students at Union County College, they decided to take Italian. Now, I'm not Italian. My wife is not Italian. We do not live in an Italian neighborhood. We had absolutely no plans to send our children to Rome for a vacation. Why they studied Italian is beyond me. But they both took Italian. They took the class together. I soon figured it out, and when these two creeps were in the house, sitting at the dinner table, and they wanted to talk to each other, and they didn't want my wife and I to know what the hell they were talking about, they were speaking to each other in Italian. So help me, this is the truth. Mrs. Darney and I enrolled in the local evening school, the high school in our community, and we took Italian so that we would know what the hell they were talking about when they spoke to each other in Italian. Necessity is the mother of invention. You sign up for your Italian class and things hum along beautifully for the first 3 weeks of the semester until Professor Dr. Hawley announces she's going to be giving her first quiz in her Italian class. And she tells you that it's going to be some matching and some fill-in and some short answers and what have you, and some multiple choice. And she says, and by the way, there will be a small section on vocabulary, so make sure you're familiar with the definition of certain terms in Italian. You get into that test and you sit down and you start taking it and you come to the section of the test that deals with vocabulary, and they give you an English word and you're supposed to write down the Italian equivalent and define it. And as you look at each word, because you've had 3 years of Spanish in high school, the only damn thing you can think of is the Spanish equivalent for that English word and its definition, and that's not going to get you anywhere. What's happening? Previous learning is now interfering with present learning. That's called proactive interference. It's a type of negative transfer of learning. Proactive, that's when old learning or previous learning interferes with present learning. Sometimes called proactive inhibition. Proactive interference. That's one kind of negative transfer.
This is when old learning interferes with new learning?
That's right. So you take a driver's ed course and you pass it. They issue you a driver's permit. The world is a much less safe place. Your family, you come from a family of very bright people. And since they know you the way they know you, no one in your family will get into an automobile with you behind the wheel. So you persuade a friend of yours to be your licensed driver and to let you practice on their car. And they have a Volkswagen Beetle, an old one, 1972 model, held together with baling wire and duct tape. And you learn to shift and to integrate the clutch and the accelerator, and you learn to drive that thing, and they are kind enough to actually take you for your driving test. And you use their vehicle, and you take the test over in Plainfield, and you pass with flying colors. And heaven help us all, you're now a licensed driver in the state of New Jersey. Shortly after doing that, you've been working a part-time job for years. You have saved sufficient money in a bank account that you're able to go out and buy your own car, since nobody in the family will loan you theirs. And you get your dream car, a 1974 Dodge Dart, olive green with a torn vinyl top, huge rust spots on it, but it's all yours. It gets you to and from school. It gets you to and from your part-time job. It gets you where you want to go. You drive that car for the next 4 years, never touching a car with a stick shift. not since you got your driver's license. Then one day you go to a company picnic with a friend of yours, and at the picnic there's a softball game. You're invited to participate. You say, I'd rather watch. It is, after all, their company. Your friend participates. They hit a double, try to stretch it into a single, slide into third base, hit a rock while sliding into third base, and break their elbow, and they come over to you in excruciating pain and say, by the time we call the rescue squad and they get here, I'm going to die from the pain. Please drive me to the hospital, and they hand you your keys. They give you the keys to their vehicle, which happens to be a Jeep Wrangler with a stick shift, one of which you haven't driven in the last 4 years. And if they think they're in pain now, wait until you try to drive them to the hospital. Forgetting that you have to depress the clutch before you put the brake on. Giving it too much gas and practically dumping them in the back of the Jeep every time you take off from a stoplight. Lurching and slamming and banging against the dashboard. By the time they get there, they'll be ready to shoot you. What are we talking about? Negative transfer of learning. That learning in your past has interfered with the original learning that took place, and now you can't drive a stick shift. So the second type we're talking about is called proactive interference. First type was proactive. Second type is retroactive. Retroactive interference is when more recent learning interferes with original learning that took place. Retroactive interference is a kind of negative transfer in which more recent learning interferes with original learning that took place, sometimes called retroactive inhibition. So we got two types of negative transfer, either one of which, or positive transfer, would be sufficient to disqualify that code swing method of study as a viable method of research. You need to be careful when you look at or read about studies that are done that employ something like this or a variation. Because of those problems attendant to that, psychology went back to the drawing board. Don't let me slip this one past you. Went back to the drawing board and came up with a new method of conducting experiments that is largely the brainchild of, notice the pause, John B. Watson, who was the mastermind, John B. Watson, the mastermind of the modern experimental method in psychology. If you look in your book, you'll find it under what's often referred to as the conclusive experimental method or the ultimate experimental method. That's the way Siegel refers to it. This is the method that, since its introduction, has been the method of choice for research in psychology. Now we can address the problems that were brought up by these two young women over here and these two gentlemen over here in terms of doing research.
What? Yeah, for the modern experimental method, who made that up?
Watson.
Okay, yeah.
First of all, using this method, we don't use one group, we use two. One group is going to use the old method, the original method. The other group is going to use the new method. We're going to conduct their experience, their training, simultaneously. But before we do that, there are some things that we have to talk about. First of all, nobody blinked when I said all the little kids in that community. All the elementary school children in the community to participate in the study will be in the poorhouse. Unless you are endowed by some kind of a grant or a foundation, you can't conduct that kind of large-scale research. What you conduct initially in this kind of situation is something called, put it in quotes, a pilot study. An experiment or research design that's done on a small scale to see if it works, to iron out any of the glitches or bugs in the study.
falls.
There it is. A pilot study. So before I can, off the top of my head, in 3 days, come up with some kind of an experiment to pacify this superintendent of schools, who deserves much better than that, I really need to give this some thought, and I need to come up with more information in order to design a study that will be worth something. My first question to him would probably be, yours is a small community. Can you give me some idea of how many children there are in the primary grades in your community? Yeah, it's a small community, and we have all total in our elementary schools, and for the non-math majors in the room, I'm going to use round numbers. We have 5,000 children. That is the universe of potential subjects. Any of those 5,000 kids potentially could participate in our study. Do we need to use all of them? No. How many do we need to use in order for this to be a scientifically valid study? Rule of thumb. 10% of that group of 5,000 needs to be included. 500 kids. The 500 children selected from the potential subjects that could be part of it is referred to as our population. That's the population of the study. It has to be a representative population. So I'm going to take issue with Philip Zimbardo, who said you can select those children to participate randomly. If you do, you will irrevocably damage your study. You will not be able to place any credence in the results, because it is entirely possible that although you're trying to do a study to show how two different methods of teaching reading will affect all kids, it is entirely possible that just by chance, look at the lady who won the lottery twice, just by chance you could pick all of the bright kids in that school system and have no idea how either one of those teaching methods will affect average kids or kids who are struggling to learn. Or you could pick all slow learners and have no idea whether these methods will nurture bright, capable kids or even average kids, but who are good readers, who are reading on grade level. So what you need to use is something called stratified random sampling. You've got to select people to be part of your study because they meet certain selection criteria. Question?
Could a pilot study also be called a representative study?
No, because all studies have to be representative. That's what we're wrestling with right now. You have to have a group of people that you run the study on that represent. In other words, that group of 500 has to be exactly like the group of 5,000, only smaller. Okay? An exact replica of the larger population. Because when we're done with our study, please note, this is called action research. The results that we get, the conclusions that we get from those results, and the recommendations we make to the school system, after we analyze the conclusions and the results, are going to impact all 5,000 kids, not just 500, all of them. So this small group has to represent the large group because ultimately they're all going to be affected by it. Stratified. What do I mean by that? Well, I got to ask this guy some more questions. My question, how many of these children are male and how many are female? And he needs to give me the exact percentages, and when he tells me 51% are male and 49% are female,
I have to have those exact same percentages here. Why? To represent the, yes, to represent that group. Why am I interested in that kind of selection criteria, however? Why am I worried about that? Why am I worried about gender? These are elementary school kids. Can't bring, okay. Do you know what different results they can bring? Yes. Very good. Nice fishing expedition. Let me tell you. There are 106 males born for every 100 females. Mother Nature's way of trying to compensate for the fact that male infants are more fragile. The infant mortality rate among male babies is much higher. That's because among female babies, they are born more mature. Little girl babies are more mature at birth. Their nervous systems are more mature. Their skeletal structure is more mature. They are taller. They weigh more. There is a process by which the two different halves of the brain become specialized in what they do earlier in little girls than in little boys. And in the left side of that brain, that is where we process language information. We're talking about reading language. Little girls learn to talk earlier than little boys. They have greater language facility. They learn foreign languages more easily. And through the first six grades of school, little girls do better for exactly the reason you stated. Education for the first 6 years of school is all verbally oriented. It isn't until you get to 7th, 8th, and 9th grades where you start dealing with nonverbal reasoning, spatial relationships, mathematical skills, etc., where boys begin to catch up and achieve some level of parity. So we're talking about kids just entering school, and I've got to have some way of relating that to natural abilities that kids have. Okay, gender. I want to know something about birth order in the family. Only children and oldest children are different than younger kids or middle kids in the family. The parents have more time to sit down and read or talk to firstborn kids or only children. They read magazines to them. They read stories to them. When you have four or five kids, you don't have the time, unless you rotate it, but it's still not the same, you don't have as much time for one-to-one interaction. And we know that the more that parents talk to and talk with little children, the earlier they develop language skills. So we're talking about a whole area of language here. I want to know how many kids come from single-parent families versus how many come from intact families. I'm going to find out 48% of the kids come from single-parent families, perhaps, something approaching that number. Why? Because that also influences the amount of time the child has to spend in one-to-one interaction verbally with the one parent that they live with or who is the principal child caregiver in that non-intact family unit. Level of education of parents. How many of the parents of those kids graduated high school? How many of them had some college? How many graduated from college? That may be a significant influence. Some kids come from families where they have a parent, like I did, who repeatedly says to their child, why do you spend so much time with your nose in a book? There's only so much you can learn from books. Life is the best teacher. Why don't you go outside and run around and play, get some fresh air, and remember, life is the best teacher. It's experience that counts. That was my father. He was really interested in my getting a paper route as soon as possible. The other one was my mother, and she was just the reverse of that. So it's a question of which of the two had a greater influence in terms of identifying with that parent. She was the one who was constantly reading or reading to me or discussing something that she read. Some kids come from homes where the parents say, as the kid gets up and picks up the remote and aims it at the TV, the parent says, excuse me, is your homework done?
And the kid says, yeah. And the parent follows up with, good, let me see it. He said, by the way, when you bring down your homework, bring me your assignment panel. I want to make sure I'm looking at tonight's homework, not last night's homework. I used to drive my kids crazy. Before they turned the damn TV set, I wanted to see the homework, and I wanted to see what the assignment was, and I would say things like, you really going to turn this in? You got to be kidding me. Look at that handwriting. I couldn't read that. So, we want to know lots of things about the family of origin of these kids, about their social class culture. We want to know something about the educational background of the family. And let's face it, I don't care what the family is, for most families, parents see education as an escalator in our society. It's an opportunity for their kids to get from where they are to a better life, to something else. And therefore, they have a vested interest in kids being successful in school. We're not going to have a problem getting parental cooperation for a study such as this when they learn that it could improve or enhance the education of all their children. So, now we have selected, using a whole variety, level of income, social class culture, ethnicity, culture of background, race, level of education. We even want to give all these kids an IQ test to make sure we have some average, some above average, and some below average, because we're going to apply the results to people regardless of where they fall on the normal curve of distribution. So now we've got our population, and it's exactly like the big group, just smaller. Then here's where the insanity sets in. From that population, you need to make two groups that are identical to each other. Number of males, number of females. The same criteria are used to form two groups. And those two groups are a control group and an experimental group. Each group consisting of ...250 kids. That's 25 children in 10 reading classes. Single blind, the people who are teaching those kids aren't going to know which group they're working with. Double blind, those children and their parents are not going to know which group their child is assigned to. It's a double-blind study so that nobody can suggest that we were biased. No kid could say, hey, I'm in the special group. Neither the teachers nor the parents know. Who's going to teach these kids to read? Are we going to use the teachers that have been around since dirt was invented? The ones who've been teaching in that school for 35, 40, 45? No. We're going to go to Tame, we're going to go to Montclair, we're going to go to Rutgers, we're going to go to Seton Hall, we're going to go to Fairleigh, we're going to go to Drew, we're going to go to the College of New Jersey, and we're going to hire brand new college graduates who specialized in elementary education, who have a solid grounding in language arts, and then we're going to hire those teachers on a one-year contract they've never taught before, and we're going to teach them how to teach reading our way. One group is going to be taught how to teach reading using the old method. The other group of teachers is going to be taught how to teach reading using the new method, but we're not going to tell them which method is which or which group they're going to be working with.
And double-blind is when the students or the parents don't know which group?
No, the ones who are participating in the experiment, the teachers, the experimenters don't know which group is which.
Okay.
That's what Zimbardo was talking about in the film. To avoid the placebo effect. Remember when he was talking about that? That's what he was discussing. So, we pre-test these kids. And then we teach them how to use, how to learn reading, how to develop their reading skills for a full year, at the end of which we're going to test both groups again. Now, here's the key. Don't drop the ball on this one. In the control group, we're going to teach them how to read using the old method. This group is going to be exactly like the other 4,500 kids in that school system, even to the fact that they are going to learn reading using the old method that's now being used. The one difference between these two groups is that in the experimental group, there's going to be one new factor introduced into this experimental group, and that is the new method of teaching reading. That's the one thing that isn't present in the other group. In the mid-1980s, the state of New Jersey conducted research. Throughout the state of New Jersey, every single college and university in the state participated. And what they did was to test incoming college freshmen in terms of their reading ability, reading rate, reading comprehension. They found that the average reading rate for an incoming college freshman at that time was about 350 words a minute. 10 years later, in the mid-1990s, they found a significant change from 350 words per minute. The average incoming college freshman read 100 words per minute. And they read 100 words per minute, and they comprehended 30% of what they read. In those 10 years, somebody dropped the ball. There have been all kinds of programs to correct those problems in terms of literacy in our society. They're about to do that study again, and I can't wait to see the results. And those are people who are going to Princeton and Rutgers and Fairleigh and Seton Hall, you name it. Those weren't just people who were going to nearby community colleges, but all colleges and universities across the state. They lumped them all together. So when this teacher, this superintendent of school said to me, we have a 75 to 80% success rate with our kids reading at or above the grade level that they're in, I say that school system is doing a hell of a job. They're doing an outstanding job with their children. But somebody wants to change things. Somebody wants to introduce a new method of teaching reading. Who knows? Maybe their son works for the publisher of the books that are that method of teaching reading is based on. Who knows? Politics is politics. In any event, here's what we do. When I say we treat both groups the same, you may want to jot some of this stuff down. We're going to teach them how to read and have their reading classes at the same time of the day. First thing in the morning. They come into school all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and raring to go. If you take one group of kids and you teach them how to read first thing in the morning, and you don't get around to teaching the other group until the afternoon after they've had lunch and been out to recess, running around, God, they come in smelling like a herd of goats and all they want to do is put their head down on the desk and go to sleep. You're going to screw up your study. So you teach them reading at the same time of the day, in the same part of the building. Not one up in the front of the building near the traffic on the boulevard and the other one in the back of the building. No, no. In classrooms painted the same color with the same kind of furniture, with the same kind of lighting, with the same kind of ventilation. We want to rule out everything that could possibly influence the learning experience of those kids. That's when I say we treat these two groups exactly the same, so that we can definitively say when the study's over with, the only difference between the two was the method that was used to teach them to read. That's what in the film was described as a well-designed experiment. Darryl Bem is an experimental psychologist at Boston University. He was the guy that was in that film. And when he talks about a well-designed experiment, he's talking about controlling all the factors. Now, what are those factors? Those factors are called variables. We have to control all of the variables. Now, here's where some people are going to get confused, so please, don't want anybody leaving here looking for something sharp to hurt themselves with. If you have a question, you raise your hand. I will explain it again and again until I'm blue in the face, but get it right. There's only one difference between these two groups, and it includes the one thing that's included in the experimental group that is not present in the other group. That's the new method of teaching reading. That is called the independent variable. The independent variable is the one new factor introduced by the experimenter into the experimental group that is kept out of the control group. Independent variable. The one thing that's different, the one new factor that they introduce and manipulate in that group.
Is it an experiment?
in the experimental group. In the other group called the control group, because we control everything and keep it exactly the same as it is with the rest of all the students in the school. Nothing new is added in the control group. That's our group for comparison purposes. Okay, here's the second shoe that's going to fall. At the end of our study, if there is a difference between the experimental group and the control group, and the kids in the experimental group actually read better, or they actually read worse, that's called the dependent variable. Because it's an outcome that's dependent upon the one thing that was different in that group. Raise your hand, please. Where are you? Who's got the question? Yes, sir. Dependent variable. It is the change, for better or worse, that is the direct result of the one new thing that we introduced into that group, which is the independent variable, the new method of teaching reading. Who's got a question?
So the dependent variable is the result?
The dependent variable is the change in the behavior of the subjects of the experimental group. There's also something called extraneous variables. Those are things out there that could sneak into our study without our being aware of it that could affect the outcome. Extraneous variables, sometimes called intervening variables, because they intervene in the study and send it in the wrong direction. Before we release our study to the people who commissioned it and hired us to do it, it is customary to hire an expert.
Extraneous
variables or intervening variables, and I'm about to explain them. Before we inform the people who commissioned the study, and before we get paid, we have to have somebody come in and check out the study. An expert who looks it over to see if they find any bugs or errors or things we didn't think about or things we didn't recognize. Is it a valid study? Is it a reliable study? Those kinds of things. I'll get to those in a minute. We hire an expert. They come in with their briefcase. They take the study, put it in the briefcase, close it up, and they leave town. And so I'll get back to you in a couple of weeks. And boy, they want a whopper of a check for this. And they get back and they say, you know, Professor Darney, we found something rather curious, interesting, and perhaps even significant. You know, the children in that experimental group did read better. But here's one of the things we found. Did you know that every morning before the kids in the control group went to school, they had breakfast consisting of cereal, or eggs, or waffles, or Pop-Tarts? They usually had either apple juice or tomato juice or orange juice with their breakfast. And as a breakfast beverage, all of the kids in the control group had either a glass of milk or a cup of hot chocolate before they went to school. And I say, yeah. Yeah. And by coincidence, did you know that all the kids in the experimental group also had breakfast before they went to school, consisting of eggs, waffles, cereal, Pop-Tarts, pancakes, whatever? They had juice in the morning, tomato juice, orange juice, apple juice, whatever. And as a breakfast beverage, they all had a cup of coffee before they went to school. And what your study has actually measured is the effect of caffeine on the immature nervous system of young children. And it has nothing to do with their ability to read, that every kid who was in that experimental group just by chance came to school jacked up on caffeine. And that's why their test scores were better, and that's why they performed better. Ladies and gentlemen, that is an extraneous or intervening variable that is enough to absolutely ruin a scientific study. There's the one thing we didn't control for, diet. So we then know that if we want to run this study, we have to serve all of those kids a free breakfast in school before they go to school, before they go to class, so that we can control their intake to make sure that they're not consuming something that's going to affect their performance. That's an intervening variable, diet. Okay, I just threw some terms at you, and I want to get back to those terms, and then I'll respond to your question. Number one, is it a valid study? That means, does the study actually measure what it's supposed to measure? Does it measure the effectiveness with which a particular method helps kids learn to read? Is it a valid study? Number two, is it a reliable study? Every time it's done, this is reliability, every time it's done, do you get either the same or very similar results? Because that's what's important. Our study is relatively insignificant. We want to publish it so that other people will read it and they will replicate the study, and that's the next one, repeatability. Every single experiment must be designed in such a way that it's repeatable. If it doesn't meet that standard, if it isn't repeatable, then it's not worth the effort and the time it took to do it. If it's just a one incident, it can happen because of any kind of a fluke or accident. It has to be repeatable. Other researchers have to do it. They have to repeat the study. And if they get the same or similar results, it increases the scientific validity of ours. So we want to publish our results of this pilot study. So the people come along and say, okay, now let's do this on a larger scale. Instead of doing it in this little community in Union County, let's do it simultaneously in Camden and in Trenton and in Elizabeth and Newark and see if we get the same results. Just a second. Your question is?
My question is, I have two questions. One of them is the intervening variable. If the intervening variable only relies when it, after the study's been going on, or can you, if you already account for that, like the diet, let's say you're already okay, everybody's going to have a few breakfast in the morning. Is the intervening variable only?
No, it's something that sneaks into the study that screws up the outcome.
Okay.
Your question.
You said it was three of them or two?
Two what?
You said, is it
three things. Is it repeatable? Is it valid? Is it reliable? I just gave it to you in reverse order. I'm sorry. Okay. Validity, reliability, repeatability. Those are the three standards, the three criteria that have to be met for a good experiment to be conducted. Second question.
You said that the outcome, the change of behavior, experimental groups called the dependent variable.
Right.
Is there any case where there's no change of behavior, and if there is, what's
the... Yes, then the study is null and void, you didn't prove anything. It is conceivably possible that both groups, after we do it, could read exactly the same. No difference. None whatsoever. So why change? But at least we did the study to demonstrate that to the principal of the school before he goes out on a limb and buys all the materials. We can say, hey, if this method, and it's got to be, look, if somebody says to me, you know, 5 out of 10 kids in that experimental group read better than the kids in the control group, my answer is yeah, then it's not worth changing. Because I can get the same results with the flip of a coin. That's a 50-50 proposition, okay? But if you tell me that the kids in this group read better 8 out of 10 times, 9 out of 10 times, 7 out of 10 times, then 75 out of 100 kids read better using this method, that's what's called a significant difference. What you just described is called a non-significant difference, and it means don't bother to make the change.
Okay.
It invalidates what we attempted to prove. Any other questions? Do yourself a big favor, and when you go home, I want you to look up those terms in the book and make sure you have an adequate definition for them. That's not a threat, it's a promise. You will encounter those terms again, trust me.